teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works, the religious and scholar life of the most outstanding Muslim ladies, personalities and dignitaries of Shiite world and Islamic world. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai are the two special guest speakers for today's discussion from the Islamic Hawza of Qom. Sheikh Rouhani, salam alaikum, brother.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, salam alaikum.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding lady of Islam, the mother of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, the wife of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. She is no one but Shahrbanu. Shahrbanu is a Persian name for this lady. Sheikh Rouhani, give us some details about the early life and background of Bibi Shahrbanu. Bibi means mother or lady in Farsi or Persian language.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Shahrbanu, mother of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam, was one of the daughters of Yazdgird, the last king of the ancient Persia.
Yes.
In one of the battles, actually, she was taken as captive by the Muslims, and she was brought to the city of Medina.
Mm-hmm.
When she was brought to the city of Medina, it is said that Imam Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam asked her that she can marry some of the children of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam or the others. Then it is said that Bibi Shahrbanu, or the Lady Shahrbanu, freely decided to marry Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Actually, she was at that time free. She was not captive.
Okay.
Yeah, after she was brought to Medina, she was free. And freely she decided to marry Imam Hussein.
So you mean Imam Ali alayhi salam freed this lady?
Yeah, yeah, first, yeah.
And then let her select her husband.
Yeah, of course.
Right. And Imam al-Hussein was selected?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Imam told him that you can either choose... let's say Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam or Muhammad, son of Abi Bakr, who was son of Imam Ali, because Imam Ali was taking care of his son. Yes, of course.
Muhammad Abdan Bakr.
And even also it is said that once the second caliph wanted to marry her as well, but she rejected and she said that I will marry only the son of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Then later she became the mother of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi alafu al-Tahiyyati wasalam, and she was also present in the event of Ashura in the land of Karbala.
That's all right. So, belonging to a Persian dynasty or Persian lineage, we can say on that time, of course, is very much controversial. There are so many controversies regarding her character. But can we for sure say that Shahrbanu was the mother of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, Sheikh Fadai, or not?
You know, there are some people believe that she was not the mother of Imam Sajjad, like Dr. Shahidi, one of the historians, Iranian historian, he believes so. But we can say that the majority of
the
scholars
public opinion
believe that she was the one who was the mother of Imam Sajjad and the wife of Imam Hussein. And, you know, when we have different viewpoints about the historic events, we should lean on the public and famous and the common one and the most famous one. But I want to mention points. You know, this is not important whether she, as the one of the daughters of the king of Iran at that time, Persia, whether she was the daughter of that king or not.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we
know that Yazdegerd was a title given to so many of the kings, for example, Yazdegerd, Avval, Dovom, Sevom, the first one, the second one, the third one, okay?
His father was the third one.
Like Khosrow, which was a title given to so many of the, for example,
kings. Her father was the third Yazdegerd in Iran, in Sasanid dynasty. But I want to mention that this is not important, whether she was the daughter of Yazdegerd, the first one, second one, or the third one. I think that the most important point about her is that, as all the scholars believe, that she was a servant when she was brought to Medina.
Uh-huh.
And then at that time, servant didn't have any respect, didn't have any, mm-hmm. Position in the minds of people. But Islam changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
A servant from a region that was not Muslim at that time, Persia at that time was not Muslim. So we can say a kafir one. So servants were kafir, but they were not Muslim. A servant changed to mother of Imam. Wife of Imam. We can say that being wife of Imam is not important because we have some Imam with bad wives.
Mm-hmm.
But what about mother? When she became a mother of Imam, so we cannot say that she was an ordinary one. So let's talk about slavery here.
Mm-hmm.
Some people ask question that if slavery is not good, why did Islam continue that?
Yes.
Like what we have in about Shahbanu.
Mm-hmm.
They brought a slave from Persia to Medina.
Mm-hmm.
So Islam continued the custom of slavery.
Yes.
No, it's not important. It's not the reality. I want to mention two points. The first point is that changing a culture and changing a custom is not easy. It cannot happen in a short time.
Yes.
It takes time. It takes a lot of time to, for example, clear a bad custom or culture, as now we don't have any servants.
We know that at the time of Prophet Muhammad, there were so many negative behaviors. For example, burying alive the girls or marrying as many women as possible, drinking blood or so many of that. So it said, Islah. Or reform in a society.
It takes time.
It takes gradual
first,
time.
It takes time. And
the rights of the slaves were really changed by Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams, isn't it?
Yes, of course.
Money were spent on freeing the slaves.
The second point is that Islam changed that threat to an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
While you are trying to change that culture, you can use that threat as an opportunity. How? In Islam, you can take a slave, but this slavery is an educational system.
Mm-hmm.
The slaves were brought to the house of Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
They were taught.
Yes.
They were educated.
Okay.
Some of them were the ashab of prophets and imams.
That's right.
Some of them were fathers and mothers of the best people that time, like Shahbanu.
Yes.
So slavery in Islam is a system of education.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just some tools in order to make them work for us or
mm-hmm.
in order to have sexual joy from them. No, it's not at all.
And we know that it's not really applicable in today's life of the Muslims. There is no more.
As I told you, it took time and now it disappeared.
Disappeared.
But at the time that Islam was working on that,
uh-huh.
Islam changed
that
threat
to an opportunity. It was a part of Arab culture.
Yes, it is.
So Islam came in order to reform this Arab culture.
You cannot change it suddenly, but you can use it as your tool.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Sheikh Rouhani, some of the Orientalists who have studied Islam and the Shia Islam believe that the marriage of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to Shahrbanu was the main cause for the Persians to become Shiite. Is this true or not?
I don't think so, because the following of Ahl al-Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam first was spreaded in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
Because the early Shiite or the early followers of Amir al-Mu'minin and Ahl al-Bayt were the people of Yemen, for example.
Okay.
Were the people of Kufa. Or the people of Iraq, people of, let's say, Arab Peninsula. And then from there, we see that it was spread all over the Islamic territory.
Okay.
So that's why the first early Shiite are mostly the Arabs.
Yes.
We cannot say that Shia or Tashayu was spread it only because of this, let's say, tribal or let's say blood kind of relationship.
We know that before, for example, the Safavid dynasty, majority of the rulers of Persia were Sunnis, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, of course.
So
yeah,
80-90% of the society was under the rulership of the Sunnis.
Yeah.
The Sunni outstanding scholars like Muslim and Bukhari were Persians, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and also we should know that even right now or nowadays in the temporary, let's say, authors of different works, they are of the view that Shahrbanu was the mother of Imam Sajjad. Now it's well known, but in the previous centuries, in the early centuries of Islam, lots of names are mentioned in Manawi or in the Islamic sources. For example, Hawla, Barra, Maryam, Sulafa, Fatima. They are some of the names of mother of Imam Sajjad. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the sources, for example, Ibn Shahrashub mentioned these names.
Yes.
Or, for example, in Al-Kulayni and Al-Kafi, Ibn Kathir and Al-Bidayah and Al-Nihaya,
yes.
in Tariq Qummi,
yes.
we've seen these names, the Arabic names like Khawla, Barra, Maryam, Fatima, they were the name of, or Harrara or Ghazala, Yaqubi, in Tariq Yaqubi mentioned that the name was Ghazala. Or it is also said that one of Kanis from Khorasan, from Kabul, was mother of Imam Sajjad, alayhi salam. So different views were there. We cannot say that at that time, this idea was well known that only Shahrbanu was the mother
but
of Imam
Sajjad. But you mean the recent research?
Yeah, they say that this is something well known nowadays. And also, we see that when the event of Ashura happened, after the event of Ashura, it was mostly Arabs who resisted against the Amawites and the people of Medina, people of Mecca, people of Kufa. I don't think so. It's a kind of false accusation that is leveled against Iranians.
But for sure, Persians had a role, for example,
of course.
In helping
Mughal. Yeah, they had a role. But if we accuse them as this, that they only followed
Araq al-Ajam or Araq al-Farsi.
If you say that they only loved Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam or Imam Sajjad because of his mother, then that's not
this
true.
This is not the point. That's right.
It is based on ma'rifah, on iman, of
like
the
Salman al-Farsi, who based on ma'rifah, you know, whose name was Ruzbeh or Behruz from Isfahan of Iran, long way, man, from Persia, coming to Medina, Mecca, knowing Prophet Muhammad, and then converting into the religion of Islam. That's right. And the concept of the isma of the a'imma is not taken something, for example, from the holiness of the kings of the Sassanids, because some of the, for example, Orientalists like Edward Brown and other Orientalists believe that, for example, the concept of isma of the a'immas were taken from the holiness of the kings of Persia because they believed in these...
And the isma of the kings.
And the isma of the kings, yes. We can say, and the holiness of... But this is not true.
They are not true, you know, because the prophets are infallible. It's mentioned in the Holy Quran.
Infallibility and isma is something different from the holiness, for example, of the kings. And Shahid Murtaza Mutahari, may Allah bless his soul, has answered so many of these, we can say, questions. Sheikh Fadai, any point?
You know, there were a lot of accusations to Islam and Tashayyu.
Yes.
We didn't take our beliefs from the blood relationship, I don't know, from the feminism, about the nationalism. We have a lot of reasons for our beliefs. So if we want to just lean on these accusations, you can go more. You can go forward. Why do you talk about Tashayyu? You can talk about Islam. So what is the accusation about Islam in Iran? They say Islam was brought to Iran by sword in the time of the second caliph. They invaded Iran and they forced Iranian people to be Muslim.
Yes.
So which is the one of the accusation of Islam in Iran. If this is like that, so what about China? Nowadays we have a lot of Muslim in China. Did Arab people invade China? Of course not. What about other countries that would have Muslim? Yes, they invaded
Indonesia.
Indonesia. Now the biggest Islamic country is Indonesia.
Yes.
That Arab people even didn't see it. Maybe they didn't know that there was a region at that time.
Indonesia.
So it is not like that. Or for example, We have Samaneh Maghribia from Morocco as mother of Imam. So she was from Morocco.
Yes.
But can you say that Moroccan people are Shia now?
Mm-hmm.
Because the mother of Imam was Shia, mother of a Shia Imam
or
was
Najas
from
Khatun,
there.
For example.
Of course not.
Yes, that's right.
You know, these nationalist accusation, mm-hmm. you know, they don't matter.
Yes.
We have enough reason for our belief.
Yes.
So we don't need to take care about that.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai. There is a bog'a, or grave-like thing, attributed to Shahr Banu in Shahr Ray. It's not authentic.
Yeah, it is superstitious.
Yeah, it's not authentic. Nowadays, of course, so many people pay visit to that, you know. But this has not been mentioned as an authentic bog'a or cemetery.
That's a problem. Unfortunately, whenever we see some shrine, we start to worship that shrine. It's not real. We should study about it.
Alhamdulillah, the new generation of the ulama of the houses, you know, are doing lots of research regarding the trustworthiness of the lineage of descendants, imamzadas and the a'immas, you know. This has not been approved yet, for example, according to the latest studies, Bug'e Shahr Banu in Shahr Ray. For example, Hazrat Abdulazim al-Hassani in Shahr Ray is known to all, okay? Right. There has been lineage, there has been stories over there, there has been authentic records and documents showing that this is the grave of Hazrat Abdulazim al-Hassani. But this one, no. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Shahr Banu, wife of Imam al-Hussein and mother of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fiyama.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
به واسطه یه هفت جهت من گناه میکنم یا به واسطه دو تا گوشام چه مسیحیت.
The major reasons for our committing sins in this world are seven organs of our body. Two ears, two eyes, mouth, tongue, and our sexual organ, which are totally seven. There are also seven gates in the hell. There are seven entries for sin in this world, and seven gates to go to the hell in the other world. We must ponder upon this point, and we must think about the consequences of our deeds in the future. This world passes like a breeze. In a narration, we read that once Gabriel appeared to the Holy Prophet, fearful and worried. Prophet Muhammad asked about the reason for his fear.
حضرت حق آتش را ایجاد کرد، هزار سال، چند هزار سال را نمیدونم، بهش دمید تا قرمز شد.
Gabriel said that when Allah created the fire, he blew in it for thousands and thousands of years to change it to what is considered as the hellfire for sinners. Through this picture, Gabriel wanted to say that a harsh chastisement awaits those who commit sins and violate the rulings of Allah on earth. Thus, we Muslims must think more about our deeds in this world and take care that our seven organs of the body do not change into the entry to the hellfire for us in the other worlds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Do not forget to visit our website at parshtoday.ir, Cut of Islam page. And until another episode and another short speech of a great alim or a scholar, fi amanillah, God bless you all.
In the limelight.
Evidence is already mounting of the war's destructive impact on the Zionist regime's economy. Experts say the cost to the Zionist regime's economy of its war on Gaza will be unlike anything it has experienced in decades. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, as Israeli tanks roar deeper into Gaza City, chugging smoke along the besieged territory's roads, pulled from incessant bombings, the regime is getting mired in the quicksand of its rage, which could ultimately seal its fate. Lost in their fury, Israeli leaders have shown total abandon and lack of inhibition in their apocalyptic obliteration of Gaza, but they are wantonly oblivious to the chilling effect that the war is having on every semblance of the Zionist regime's survival. Evidence is already mounting of the war's destructive impact on the Zionist regime's economy. Experts say the cost to the Zionist regime's economy of its war on Gaza will be unlike anything it has experienced in decades. Recently, a group of about 300 senior Israeli economists wrote to the regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and its extremist finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, harshly criticizing them for their detachment from the looming disaster. They warned in the letter, "You do not understand the magnitude of the economic crisis that Israel's economy is facing." Among the signatories of the letter were Professor Jacob Frenkel, former governor of the Bank of Israel, Rani Hezkiyahu, former Bank of Israel supervisor of banks and accountant general, Yair Avidan, former supervisor of banks, Hayim Shani, former finance ministry director general, Professor Eugene Kandel, former chairman of the National Economic Council, former deputy governor of the Bank of Israel, Professor Eitan Sheshensky, Professor Leo Lederman of Tel Aviv University, and 2021 Nobel Prize winner in economics, Joshua Angerist of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They urged Netanyahu and Smotrich to come to your senses and immediately halt all non-essential expenditure items in the budget in order to cope with the looming economic crisis. Technology and tourism are the main growth drivers of the Zionist regime's almost $500 billion economy. Both sectors are the worst hit by the conflict. The tech industry accounts for 18% of Israel's GDP and half of all exports. According to an Israeli survey, about 70% of tech firms and startups are already facing disruptions in their operations, as a chunk of their employees have reported for reserve duty. The survey said the initial disruption has been so severe that only 12% of Israeli manufacturers were at full-scale production after 2 weeks of war. Most cited staff shortages as their biggest problem. The Labor Ministry says 764,000 Israelis, or 18% of the workforce, are not working after being called up for reserve duty, evacuated from their towns, or forced by school closures. Meanwhile, more than 126,000 Israelis from the north and south of the occupied territories have been relocated amid the ongoing exchange of fire from Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Many companies, from builders to restaurants, have also shut, and other retail firms have furloughed their employees. In the construction sector, which is heavily reliant on 80,000 Palestinians living in the West Bank, Many workers are missing. This means the Israeli regime is on course to lose a significant chunk of its tax income from real estate and see a new price surge in the housing market, which is already among the most expensive in Europe and West Asia. A survey of Israeli businesses by the Central Bureau of Statistics found that 1 in 3 had closed or were operating at 20% capacity or less since it began, while more than half had reported revenue losses of 50% or more. The results were even worse for the south, the region closest to Gaza, where 2/3 of businesses had either shut or reduced operations to a minimum. However, as the Zionist regime's economic prospects continue to darken, the gravest threat to its future ironically comes from within. According to Leo Lederman, chief economic advisor to Bank Hapoalim, which is one of Israel's biggest banks, there is an emotional crisis among the Israeli public, and it is already taking a toll. He said spending by households has collapsed because of the uncertainty and the mood, dealing a major shock to the consumer sector that accounts for about half of gross domestic product. Recently, the Israeli regime's finance ministry estimated that the war in Gaza will cost as much as $51 billion, but it was dismissed as optimistic. Experts say the geographical reach and duration of the conflict will determine the extent of its long-term economic impact. The financial toll is already stacking up. The shekel, currently at its lowest value since 2012, is heading for its worst yearly performance this century. Meanwhile, Israeli stocks are the world's worst performers since the war began. And by all indications, the crisis is going to leave long-lasting scars across the Zionist regime's economy, from which it might never recover given the emotional and psychological jolt that the entity has suffered.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, degrees of humility. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We understand that humility is the opposite of arrogance. We know that arrogance is highly disliked by Allah. We know that there are numerous verses and ahadith about humility and arrogance. The question one may ask is, are there any degrees to humility? Let's turn towards a saying of Imam Qasim alayhi salam to seek an answer. The Imam says there are degrees of humility. One of them is to understand one's merits and capabilities and to use them duly with a pure heart. A man like this should not behave with people in a manner which he dislikes for himself. He will repay bad deeds with good deeds, restrain his anger, and pardons men. And Allah loves the doers of good to others. So this is a narration of Imam Qasim alayhi salam in which he explains the degrees of humility. Just like we have degrees of iman, right, faith. Just like we have degrees of taqwa, right. When it comes to humility, some people are just bare minimum humble.
you know, some of their actions, they kind of indicate that they're humble people. Others are better than that. And in terms of some of their actions, they do other things that complement those actions and create this feeling of comfort for the poor, for instance, you know, comfort for other Muslims. And Muslims are, they feel welcomed to approach him to seek help, right? This is also part of being humble. So there are different degrees of being humble, which we should study more about and inshallah try to inculcate it in our lives. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing about the degrees of humility. How many times have we noticed that people's greetings with the poor are different from their greetings with the rich ones? Unfortunately, even in masjids, even in Husainiyas, even, you know, you go and attend a majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you see this happening more frequently than we notice, right? So this is very unfortunate. You know, this is a trait of the those who are the people of the dunya, ahlul dunya, that they look at somebody's wealth and then treat them based on their wealth status, right? In Islam, the respect of a believer is more than Kaaba, right? So now, that respect is not dependent on his wealth or richness status, right? If anything, the respect of a mu'min is dependent on the level of taqwa he possesses, right? But unfortunately, in materialistic societies that we live in, things are upside down. We notice that people, they are respected because of the type of car they drive, based on the house that they possess, based on their job title, for instance, based on the number of degrees they have, based on their, I don't know, so many other factors like, you know, the type of phone, especially when it comes to youth, the type of phone that they're carrying, you know, so on and so forth. Divine values, unfortunately, have disappeared from our societies, even within Muslim circles, right? Imam Ridha alayhi salam says, the eighth Imam, anyone who greets a poor Muslim in a manner different from his greeting a rich one, Allah will be angry with him on the Day of Judgment. Look how explicit the Imams are in guiding us. So let's inshallah try to respect the poor, be humble in front of poor, and you know, those Muslims who are less fortunate, let's try to help them out and be respectful towards them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Home Secretary Suella Braverman has called for further action against pro-Palestine marchers and protesters. Suella Braverman's rhetoric is dividing Conservative MPs who are frustrated that Prime Minister Sunak has not sacked her. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Suella Braverman has demanded further action against pro-Palestine marchers as centrist Conservative MPs express despair at Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's delay in sacking his rogue Home Secretary. One senior backbencher predicted a lot of noise from angry colleagues when they returned to Parliament on Monday. With no signs of imminent action from Prime Minister Sunak after a series of controversies involving Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary. Another MP said, every day she remains in office, it further undermines the Prime Minister's authority. In her first public pronouncement since far-right groups fought police officers near the Cenotaph, the Home Secretary made no comment on claims by the Labour Party and the Metropolitan Police that tensions had been inflamed in part by her own rhetoric. Condemning violence among both a large pro-Palestine demonstration and what she termed counter-protesters, Suella Braverman focused on what she called sick, inflammatory and in some cases clearly criminal chants, placards and paraphernalia openly on display at the main march. Writing on X, formerly known as Twitter, she said, "This can't go on. Week by week, the streets of London are being polluted by hate, violence and anti-Semitism. Members of the public are being mobbed and intimidated. Jewish people in particular feel threatened. Further action is necessary." Last week, Suella Braverman provoked fury after she ignored No. 10 Downing Street's request that she tone down an opinion piece for the Times newspaper, in which she accused the police of bias in how they deal with political protests. While her statement on Sunday, 12th of November, was not in open defiance of Prime Minister Sunak, it indicated that Braverman is not minded to tone down her language, which has dismayed a number of Conservative MPs. Ministerial social media posts are not normally vetted by No. 10 Downing Street. The Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, accused Braverman of being damaging and irresponsible, but the Defence Secretary Grant Shapps dismissed the idea the Home Secretary's approach had emboldened far-right marchers, accusing the Labour Party of trying to play politics over the issue. The counter-protest was already going to happen, he told Sky News' Sunday morning programme with Trevor Phillips. Those people who were going to come and try and disrupt this weekend had already said they were going to do it. Speaking on the same show, the Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper said, "Suella Braverman decided to launch an unprecedented attack on the impartiality of the police and also to deliberately inflame tensions in the run-up to Remembrance Weekend. No Home Secretary has ever done that before." Allies of Suella Braverman and a number of Tory MPs believe No. 10 Downing Street is not minded to sack the Home Secretary immediately, especially given Wednesday's Supreme Court ruling on the plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda, a key part of her policy brief. Some expect her to stay on until a reshuffle, even though other sources warn that Prime Minister Sunak could still act swiftly. However, the sense of indecision has alarmed Conservative MPs who want her to be removed and who fear that Prime Minister Sunak is too weak to stand up to her allies on the right of the Conservative Party.
There have been doubts over claims that her allies number 50 or more. I can see the logic of her staying on for the Rwanda judgment on Wednesday, but if it goes much beyond that, it looks like she won the battle, one backbencher said. And no one wants to see their prime minister on the losing side. Another backbencher said it's not a surprise at all that this has been put on ice. If they'd wanted to sack her, they would have done it already. It's expected, but it's dismaying and it's utterly shambolic. A former minister said there was despair among many conservative centrists and that they were losing faith in Prime Minister Sunak. Setting aside ethical issues, they just think all this is going to harm their electoral prospects, the former minister said. The Prime Minister does seem to have a strange predilection when any pressure appears for deciding that these right-wing nutters should be accommodated. In contrast, Braverman-backing MPs argue that examples of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic placards and chants at pro-Palestine rallies, which drew an estimated 300,000 crowd, vindicated her description of the demonstrations for a ceasefire in Gaza as a hate march. They also point to scenes on Saturday, 11th of November, where Michael Gove was jostled and heckled by pro-Palestine demonstrators at London's Victoria Station. The community secretary tweeted on Sunday to thank police for their exemplary work getting me home safely. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has spoken for the first time since the ugly scenes on the streets of London in which more than 140 people were arrested by police. Suella Braverman has doubled down on calls for more action to be taken against pro-Palestine protesters. The Home Secretary last week failed to get marchers banned over the Remembrance weekend, after the Metropolitan Police said it had the resources to manage the hundreds of thousands of people who turned up, as well as far-right counter-protests. In a series of posts on X, formerly known as Twitter, sent in the afternoon, Suella Braverman said further action is necessary against the protesters, which were resulting in the streets of London being polluted by hate, violence and anti-Semitism. The Home Secretary paid tribute to police officers, saying, "Our brave police officers deserve the thanks of every decent citizen for their professionalism in the face of violence and aggression from protesters and counter-protesters in London." That multiple police officers were injured doing their duty is an outrage. This is a marked contrast to last week when Suella Braverman accused the Metropolitan Police of holding double standards on how it polices protesters. She added, "The sick, inflammatory and in some cases clearly criminal chants, placards and paraphernalia openly on display at the march mark a new low. Anti-Semitism and other forms of racism together with the valorizing of terrorism on such a scale is deeply troubling," Braverman said. Some have accused Suella Braverman of inflaming tensions, leading to more people descending on the capital, London. More than 140 people were arrested in the disorder, both on the pro-Palestinian side and the far-right counter-protester side. The Metropolitan Police's Deputy Assistant Commissioner, Lawrence Taylor, said the force faced a really challenging day dealing with the protests. Suella Braverman's job is now on the line, with opposition parties calling on Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to sack her, and a lack of support from her ministerial colleagues.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the organizers of the National Congress of the Martyrs of Lorestan Province on October 25, 2023. I would like to say a few words about the situation in Gaza. The scope of this crime was so extensive that it has shook the conscience of the people of the world. You are seeing people in US cities, in European cities, in capital cities, and also in Islamic countries taking to the streets and openly expressing their opposition. This is even though pro-Palestinian protests have been banned in European countries that claim to have freedom of speech. This is also one of their disgraces. It is permissible to march for anything, yet it is forbidden to march in support of the oppressed. But people have ignored this ban. You saw the footage on TV where people came and participated in the protests.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
People around the world are infuriated, and we all know that this feeling of anger that has arisen in people, this guilty conscience that has arisen in these countries, will create a reaction that no one can stop. No matter how hard they try, they will not be able to stop this reaction. What I would like to emphasize is that Muslim governments should not give up in this matter. They shouldn't imagine that just because the US or some other Western countries do some stupid, wrong action and label those who defend their homes and their country as terrorists, that they should repeat the same thing. When a person defends his or her homeland against the enemy, does that make him or her a terrorist? The fake, oppressive government that has usurped their homes is the terrorist. Muslim governments should be careful, and political spokespersons should be careful not to repeat their words. They should know that in this matter and in the future, Palestine will definitely be victorious. The future world belongs to Palestine. It does not belong to the usurping Zionist regime. The future belongs to them, the Palestinians. What they, the Zionists, are doing, the oppression, the crimes, and the tragedies that they are creating are all in vain. They will not be able to do anything. God willing, by the will of Almighty God, I hope, God willing, that the Almighty God will bless the Islamic world and the Islamic nation with all that is good in this world. And may God subdue, vanquish, and humiliate the enemies of the Islamic nation. May God's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done for me through all my years. I've been
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In Gaza, the situation is getting worse, no longer by the day, but by the hour. Incessant Israeli bombardments and its refusal to lift a crippling blockade on the enclave has led to a humanitarian disaster, as described by the ICRC. More than half of the hospitals in Gaza have closed down. The situation is described as intolerable by Iranians who have supported the Palestinian resistance from day one. On the streets of Tehran, people are calling this an unbearable human tragedy unfolding before their very eyes.
We have them in any way, shape, or form that we can. The entire world is watching silently, and even Western countries, and the U.S. in particular, are blatantly supporting the Zionists as they commit these atrocities. The Palestinians are our Muslim brothers and sisters, and we have to do everything we can do to help them.
The most barbaric scenes that one could imagine are coming out of Gaza. I couldn't sleep the night as I saw images of a hospital in Gaza where a young child pulled from under the rubble was all alone crying. He was probably the only one left from his family, just like many other kids there. How can the world do nothing? All countries should call for an immediate ceasefire.
I can't believe that in year 2023 we are witnessing such atrocities. It is completely unbelievable. No one is trying to stop the Zionists. Why? Just because Palestinians don't have blonde hair and blue eyes? Just because they are Muslims? They deserve to be treated this way. We saw how all these countries who are now supporting Israel were vocal when it was all about Ukraine.
Currently, over 9 million Iranians have signed up to go to Gaza to help Palestinians in their fight for freedom.
Does international law mean anything at all, or it is just for some countries to benefit from? History will judge them. Such atrocities are completely unprecedented. I never thought that I would be seeing such images. How can they call themselves humans? How can the rest of the world just sit and watch and do nothing? Everyone should demand an immediate ceasefire and humanitarian help for Palestinians. I would go to help them if I could.
When I see these images, I feel nauseous. All these young, innocent children. Why do they have to suffer? They haven't done anything wrong. They need humanitarian help immediately.
Children, hospitals, schools, according to international law, they should not be attacked. But we see now how they are bombarded every day. There should be an immediate ceasefire. Israelis have absolutely no shame. They call themselves human. Them and all those who support these atrocities. The U.S. The international community now knows the truth about them. Them and their so-called human rights.
Israel waged a war on Gaza on October 7th. At least 11,000 Palestinians have been killed in the strikes, most of them women and children, while 27,000 others have been injured. Tel Aviv has also imposed a complete siege on Gaza, cutting off fuel, electricity, food and water to more than 2 million Palestinians living there.
Iranians are appalled by the images coming out of the Gaza Strip showing the atrocities of the Zionist regime. They are also shocked that Western countries led by the United States are supporting the Israeli regime. Iranians are calling for an immediate ceasefire and immediate humanitarian help for the people in Gaza. Yusumi Shahmadi, Press TV, Tehran.
The first international congress in tribute to the father of Iran's missile program, Hassan Tehrani Muqaddam, was held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The event also marked his 12th martyrdom anniversary. Senior military and state officials attended the ceremony to honor his lofty status and unique role in the missile program of the country.
Martyr Tehrani Muqaddam opened the chapter of self-reliance in the defense industry and put an end to the thoughts of unwilling people who said we don't have the strength to compete in any industry. He believed that we can and thus became the father of Iran's missile program.
Tehrani Muqaddam, a commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, was a key figure in Iran's ballistic missile program. An engineer by profession, he designed the Shahab, Qadr and Sajil missiles with a range of over 1,000 kilometers. Tehrani Muqaddam began establishing Iran's missile program when the country was under attack during the eight-year Iraqi imposed war on Iran. He continued his efforts to boost the program in subsequent years amid difficulties and shortages.
Today, we're at the peak of military power, and we have prepared ourselves